time to cast off on a new adventure. This is Real Adventures with Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Hadgood.
Good morning and welcome to Real Adventures from wherever you are listening right around the country. Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Hadgood joining you this morning to talk all things fishing, boating and the great outdoors. We've got a little bit of fall drive news this morning. We're going to catch up with a couple that have, I suppose, almost living the Australian dream. They packed up during COVID. They bought themselves a yacht and have been travelling right up of Eastern Australia. And I think currently the boats in the Whitsunday is one of the premier yachting and boating destinations the country has on offer. So it's a huge show of Real Adventures coming your way this morning. One of the most recognisable recreational anglers the country has on offer is also Aaron Hadgood. Good morning, Redmond.
It's fantastic to be back sitting alongside you, Patrick. Back doing the show nice and formal. Good morning to our listeners out there. And I just want to say, how good has this weather been? I know a little bit of rain during the week. It's been 30, sunny. It's been probably, we'll do the feels like, Pat. Feels like 25 on the water. It feels like. It's been beautiful. But how's the old KP been in that stadium? You got a nice breeze coming through there on those 33-degree days?
Oh, actually, it's funny you mention that. I've had a few people message me at the start of the week, you know, go for a fish. I'm training, mate. What do you mean?
I apologize, but it was
this is my manager. No, this wasn't you. This is my manager. He's like, you want to go for a fish? No, I'm running. I'm running my ass off for 13 kilometers in blood, sweat, and tears. Mostly tears and a lot of sweat. So I haven't been enjoying it, Aaron, unlike you, but there's been some, unfortunately, sort of my region of the world, there's been a few easterlies, but it's been good for fishing. Certainly there's been great reports statewide, countrywide, if you will. Certainly on the bottom end of South Australia, there's some great reports of southern bluefin tuna. We're seeing really good reports along the east coast of marlin. And then, as we've often talked about, Redmond, this time of the year, once that water temperature increases, and it's around that 20-degree mark at the moment, the kingfisher firing, the southern bluefin tuna are in really good size schools and really good size fish. It's all happening.
It is. You couldn't have said it any better. It's literally shaping up to be an absolute cracker of a summer. The weather, it's just the stability in it. I think it's because we haven't seen it for so long, Pat. It's just been, I guess, so...
It's shocked us all. Hang on, we can fish one day and then the next and then the next.
Well, some days have been fascinating, like amazing, but then you get three real bad ones and it's been just so inconsistent. But all of a sudden, the last week and a half has just been beautiful. I know we got a bit of rain at the end of the week, but anyone can handle a bit of rain when it's only blowing 10 knots from the north, but it's 60 mil of it. But it's definitely been one of those patterns that has just been sensational. It's weird because we're not getting those high-pressure systems at the moment, and we're talking about where you and I live, sitting over Port Phillip Bay like we used to. So rather than getting our northerlies, the high pressure's in a different area, and it's actually causing a hell of a lot of easterly winds. And I think it has a little bit of an effect on why we're not getting 40-degree days. I know it sounds a bit silly, but we're getting a lot of 28s to 32s, which I'm not complaining about. I think that's the perfect temperature. But it's been really stable at that. And I think it's really helped with the fishing. The kingfish have really started to fire up right along the coast. Down Mallacoota's fishing well. I know Marlow's fishing well. Portland has been on fire. Port Ferry, the whole southwest Victoria, and even into Eden. We've got a bit more information about that a bit later. But then you've got the bluefin from like you said, from all the way of South Australia down to here. And I've had a beautiful week on the water. Literally, I actually really enjoyed your Instagram stories with you and Jezza sweating your butts out. I think that made my day. But the fishing's been sensational. The whiting in Port Phillip Bay, amazing. The squid have been sensational. They're just not letting up. I've already mentioned the kingfish and the tuna. The bottom fishing gummies, the snapper are still going in Port Phillip Bay and in Western Port Bay. So everything is going really, really well. But one thing I just want to mention just quickly, Pat, before we get into a bit of shark talk is, did you say during the week, I've never seen them before, ever, and I reckon you may have, Japanese flying squid. No, I said Japanese flying squid, not fish. It's an actual squid. I'll tell you what.
The only time I've seen squid flying is when someone's flung them in the boat.
Yeah, it's usually me skull dragging them across the surface to get the next one.
It was pretty incredible to see. Before we get into a bit of in-depth analysis around not only Mako Sharks but Kingfish as well, a little bit of four-wheel drive news. Toyota have announced, rather than an all-new model of their fifth-generation Prado, they'll be facelifting their current model. Whether that sits in line with other manufacturers who continue to introduce new models, it's an interesting decision by Toyota. What we're hearing is there's ongoing production issues that have plagued pretty much every automotive manufacturer globally. So that supply chain, meaning rather than an all-new model Prado, it's just a facelifted edition. Will that impact purchases of this? We'll have to wait and see, Aaron. Toyota continues to be.
It's going to 3.3 litres twin turbo diesel V6. It's actually similar to what the Amarok did. The Amarok was only a four-cylinder. I think it was might have only been 2.2, but it's the same sort of thing. They just facelifted it. And I've got an Amarok, and I love the way it tows. It's one of the most powerful cars in its class now, and it pulls really, really well. And is it going to be the same as
But I think the point is we've seen a new Land Cruiser 300 series, which the 200 series was on the shelf for has to be close to 15 years. I think it was 2001 that first model came out. Might have even been 99, actually. And it wasn't until for the 100 series, then we see I think it's 2004, 2005, we see the 200 series and now the 300 series. I would have expected in line with that new 300 series, we'd see a new Prado, but that clearly isn't going to happen. Ford Bronco have revealed their Raptor. Now, there's still no word on whether we're going to see that in Australia. So this is their Raptor edition of the Ford Bronco. It's an incredible looking car. Unfortunately for all of us down under, we're at this stage not going to see it, Redmond. I'm not sure it's going to tow the boat as well as a Land Cruiser 300 series, but it's an incredible looking off-road vehicle.
Why won't it get here? Like, why?
Well, I'm assuming it's the cost analysis. You bring that vehicle to Australia, does it compete with other models that Ford are offering potentially? Obviously, Everest is a commitment that Ford made to Australia, essentially replacing what was the territory. And then you've got a rung beneath that, sort of the Endura. So I dare say it's an internal competition decision, but looking at it, it's an incredible looking car. It's just a shame we won't get to see it in Australia anytime soon. And one I think you'll like, as we finish our sort of fishing news, Redmond, this week, 10 years to the day almost, it was a great story published on boatsales.com. A regulator 26 centre console that survived more than 3 years at sea after a rogue wave capsized it in 2008. So the boat was recovered, back end of 2011, early 2012, off the Spanish coast. Quite extraordinary, considering where it rolled over in Nantucket.
The similar to the Bar Crusher story a few years ago, Pat. The
correct, one exactly.
And rocked up at Sydney, I think it was, or 2,000 kilometres from where it was, and it got returned to the owner at Sydney.
Well, that was New Zealand to Australia. This was almost 5,000. Kilometers away on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. It's just incredible. I'll tell you what, it's a great advertisement to regulator. And if you're in the center console market, you might want to consider their 26 because it doesn't need to be skipped for 3 years and it'll still be on the water.
So what's their advertisement? Doesn't sink for 3 years?
Something like that. Hey, earlier in the week, you caught a cracking size Mako. And we've had plenty of questions on our socials around the best way to target a Mako shark in particular. We've had a few listeners and a few of your Salt Guide members and followers that have gone out to that sort of 70-meter mark, caught blue sharks. There's plenty of sort of around that mark. But specifically for Makos, is it luck for you? Talk us through the methodology around targeting them, the time of the day, the bait that you're using, and why you did what you did.
Yeah, and another thing I want to talk a little bit about is just how to handle them at the boat two pack. So I'll get to that at the end. But, you know, I had to go chase one. It's you and I have been talking about it on the show for weeks now, just about the sharks, the shark activity right around Victoria, and it is busy. And we, you and I both called it for the start of the season. We said if the tuna rock up like they are, the shark activity is just going to get more and more. And it's shaping up to get it. It's literally borderline every day we're seeing – it's out of control. Like we're seeing, what, 3 to 10 different sharks sighted right around Victoria at the moment and close to beaches. I know during the week the Westpac chopper found 3 big bronzies sitting off where the ferry park's at Sorrento, and there's tens of thousands of people that swim right through there. Bronzies don't tend to be as dangerous, even though I believe it was the one off Ocean Grove that had that incident. But I believe they're sort of a timid shark. And if you want to target a bronzy in those shallow areas – away from swimmers and beaches, obviously, you can just set up a nice burley trail and you can catch yourself some bronzies, and they're a beautiful eating shark. Where with the makos, I'm actually heading out into the deeper waters like you spoke about before in the ocean, and I'm setting my drift up. Once again, we speak about it all the time, in changing contours. We need to change contours. So we're trying to change depths. We're trying to get a parallel to depth changes so that way we can carve our different depths or reefs that the makos are going to be traveling on. They're going to hit the burley, intercept it, and end up traveling hopefully the way that we're sitting, and that's up the burley trail and straight to the back of the boat where we are. Now, during the week, I started in about 62 meters, I think it was. I had a light southeasterly wind, and it was beautiful out there, and I actually ran baits in the water, Pat. So you might hear me often say I don't run baits in the water for a shark, or a mako particularly, until I see the shark. Now, the reason for that is we get a lot of small sharks around, but if you catch one of those on a 24-kilo outfit, they're not much fun. You're not going to have the time of your life. You sort of just going to be over before it starts.
Yeah.
So I recommend if you do want to try and have a bit of fun, try and see it before you hook it. Contradicting myself here, I did run my two baits out. The reason I did that is I ran one slightly down deeper, and I ran one up in top of the water column.
So you used a balloon essentially to keep it afloat?
Yeah, an environmental friendly balloon I think you got to use now. And used one of that, sent it out the back, and had it out the back nice and far. And it probably only like maybe 40 meters out the back of the boat. And then I had one probably 15, 20 meters that was down a little bit deeper, running wire trace with a nice big hook on it.
So as that... you see the shark as it comes up. Are we free spooling? How are we hooking that shark when it first comes on? How are we setting that rod, if it's a chagger or whatever? Are we leaving it in free spool and we're just keeping an eye on it? What's your go-to?
So what I'm doing is when the shark comes up, I'm trying to actually, like I said, I'll bust out the gear that I want to use. So if it's a smaller shark, say under 20 kilo, I might just run a gummy rod for it, Pat. If it's a big 100 kilo one or 50 kilo like we got, I ran a 24 kilo rod. But about setting the hook, you want to let it – I was there to kill. Now, I love eating sharks. Mako particularly. It's a beautiful eating shark. I wanted to keep this shark. So I ran a straight hook, not a circle hook. Circles will also work really well to if you do want to keep a shark as well. But what you want to do is you want to actually let them eat it, because it's such a big bait and such a big shark. You want to actually let them get it down their mouth. And then only for a few seconds, 3 or 4 seconds, you can go a bit longer with a circle hook. And then I go up to strike on the tip, the 24 kilo. And then I'm winding and trying to set this hook as hard as I can by pulling back into the shark with the rod.
So you're jolting it, aren't you?
Like pretty much jolting it into the shark, yep, and winding at the same time, really trying to dig this hook in. And sure enough, it went into the shark. This shark took the furthest bait back. It didn't get up to the boat. It was a nice shark around that probably 40, 50 kilo, probably around that more 50. And it was a really, really good fish. It came up nicely along the side of the boat, did a couple of big cartwheels out of the water, and sure enough, we got it. Now, the burley that I was using was all my leftover tuna scraps, Pat. So all the blood lines and all the offcuts and all the crap that you throw out, I guess. I was actually cubing that, like cutting it up and throwing it into the water, just 3 or 4 pieces every sort of few minutes, just like flicking it over as I went. And I also had burley logs out. Now, the key with your burley logs is you need to make sure they're decent ones. Don't go buying crap ones. You need to make sure that they're decent. So ask them what's in it. If they don't want to know what's in it, I'd go to a different store, because if you buy 7 or 8 burley logs, they're going to cost you $150. It's a lot of money just to waste. So yep. I'd be definitely getting good ones. I also run tuna oil out of the side of the boat. I put a hole in a tuna oil in a bottle. I hang that over the side of the boat too, because obviously tuna oil is good. You can tie up a tuna on the side of the boat as well, Pat. If you've caught a tuna the day before and you got the carcass, tie the carcass up on the side of the boat. Nothing's going to waste then. It works really well, and that works well. But the biggest key is don't let the burley stop. If you let the burley stop and you put a break in your burley trail, that shark that's swimming up to you hits the break in it, and if you've left it for 5 minutes and you've drifted 300 metres, it turns and goes the other way. Yep. You don't want to let you have that. Now, when you're handling them at the boat, as my number one rule, a mako's not dead until you've eaten it. They're just a powerful, powerful creature. And multiple ways you can handle these sharks. You can fly and gaff them, and you can fixed gaff them. The other day I just used a fixed gaff, and I got a tail rope on it as quick as I could. The easiest way to get a tail rope on it is to actually, when you gaff it, have the boat in gear with someone with the gaff, so it's the shark's actually sort of swimming with the boat. That way the head can't get to you, Pat, and you can actually put the rope on the tail. It's a bit safer. Have it tied off to the back of the boat. And then if you do have a flying gaff and you've got a big shark, you can use the flying gaff rope to tie off, and that way you're not going to hurt yourself or smash your boat up. You can tie both ropes off to wherever you need and hope it stays in, obviously. But, like, they don't die. You've got to bleed them straight away, pull them backwards. It's the only way to – like, this shark, 30 minutes
probably
later –
probably dispatch of it.
Yeah, probably dispatch it. And then once I feel as though I'm comfortable that it's dispatched, I then do my best to get the guts out of it as quick as I can. And then, if possible, I've got a big tuna barrel bag that I took out, Pat, from Mad Fish, and I got it into the bag on ice just because I wanted to look after it. I don't like killing things for no reason. I love eating mako. It's a beautiful eating shark. We've all got to eat, and it's they're probably my top few fish to eat. And we just wanted to look after it, so I filled its guts up with ice and chucked it in the ice slurry in the bag. So that there's sort of your brief way to target a mako. A few other little things that you need to do and whatnot. But although there's plenty of videos on the website, as we like to say, on Salt Guide. So make sure you check it out if you are interested. But it's well and truly worth getting out there now and chasing one, because they are so much fun.
We've got a massive show of Real Adventures heading your way this morning. Christina Casales joins me. Her and her partner, John, have been heading up north. They purchased a 50-foot boat during lockdown. They've spent time rebuilding it, doing it up, and they've been traveling up the eastern seaboard. It's an incredible story. It's a great chat. We're chatting to her a little later in the show. But after the break, we answer your questions on social media, and we've got our fishing wrap from around the country and what's biting in your state. This is Real Adventures.
You're listening to Real Adventures with Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Hadgood.
Welcome back to Real Adventures. It's time for the Whip Around Redmond and our New South Wales fishing wrap for New South Wales Maritime. Look after your life jacket and it will look after you. Don't risk your life. Let's start off in New South Wales Redmond. There's been some really good reports of some billed fish of late.
There is actually a bit of a reminder. I need to go get your boat service, to be honest. So we can get up there. It's a little reminder for myself. Sorry, I might just drop that down on the
note, Note to self. Get the boat service,
because it'll be about 400 hours by the time it gets back from my marlin fishing. Perfect. Marlin, yeah, exciting, really exciting. Up Sydney way, starting to fish better. I think everything's had a bit of an influence on it. Volcanoes, cyclones, tsunamis. I think everything's played a bit of a role. But the current's starting to shape up. I had a few boys that I spoke to during the week, the likes of Joel Ryan, Daniel Riosa. They're really renowned marlin fishermen. They do really well, and they told me to stay on the tuna for a bit longer because it just isn't quite right yet. And we're talking southeast, so more your Burmy Tathra way. But there has been some good fish off Tathra, a few fish off Burmy. They had a few comps in Burmy during the week, and say 60 boats out, 30 fish were getting caught, where normally some boats can have up to 10, 15 fish a day at times. So it's not there, but it's well worth having a crack if you're interested. Something that is interesting. Sorry.
What about any, in terms of the dolphin fish working their way down? They're always a bit of a bycatch when you're spending time fishing offshore, particularly for billfish. any really good size fish being caught or not particularly?
Yeah, no, there is. I've actually seen some. So the fads are what do a lot of the work. And not only the fads, is the traps too. So, for example, Trapman Bermagui, who's a fantastic commercial fisherman out of Burmese, and we follow him all on social media. He's got a very big audience. And he obviously sets traps out there. And when you've got a bit of current running on the traps, they hold dolphin fish too, Pat. So not just the fads work, any sort of structure there they'll hang on to. Even a log or a big bit of kelp, Pat, that's floating, dolphin fish will follow.
That was a New South Wales fishing wrap for New South Wales. Make sure your life jacket is in good working order. It can only save your life if you're wearing it. South Australia, Redmond. Our good mate, Nen McHenry, Adelaide Crow, of course, he's been taking a few of his fellow players out and they've been getting some really nice southern bluefin tuna. There's good reports of fish at the moment.
Yeah, so where are those boys out of? Sorry again, Pax. I reckon I've got Victor Harbour. I've seen some really good catches.
They've been fishing Victor, yeah. So Ned will pick up the boat and they'll drive it down south. And the beauty about Victor Harbour is you can launch and then, depending on where the fish are feeding, you're within a couple of Ks and you're all of a sudden on to fish.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, that's the reports that I'm getting. They're fishing really, really well. And big fish, up to 30 kilo. They're not too hard to catch. They've been taking lure as well. If you can get a few turns on them and locate them, casting, once again, I won't ever go past them. It's the bungee cast. They just work so, so good. Upgrade the trebles, as we always say, Pat. So that's been the tuna fishery. Like, it's running from up Victor Harbour, even further up, right down to where we are, past where we are, down right down to Gippsland Way. Like, it's just out of control. Like, it's we're only getting better and better as the fishery becomes more sustainable over the next few years. It's just going to be out of control. Like, I'm really looking forward to it because they're growing too. So remember last year, Ned, getting fish around that 15 kilo. Now these are bigger again. And it's the same thing that's happened out of here. They were 20 kilo. Now they're 30s. So, like, more often, like, you get the odd bigger one, but I'm talking about on the averages. So it's really, really, really good to see. Daily Heads has huge schools of salmon right now, Pat. I'm not sure if you've seen that on social media.
The water's black.
Literally black. So SA Angler actually posted it during the week, so we won't take the credit from Shane there. Shane gave us the report, and it's if you're out there on the beaches and you can get up nice and high, look for blackness in the water, and if they're not sharks, they're salmon. So make sure you get your metal lures into there.
Or if there's a gap between those fish, that is a shark.
Yeah, there's a good chance there will be. So West Lakes had some big mulloway caught. Now, not common, but there's been a fair few fish caught. One of the fish was well over 1.20 meters. Like, that's a big mulloway. Whether it was bycatch or not, who knows? I don't think they'll tell you that.
I'm not sure you're going to West Lakes to target your sort of meter plus mulloway, but you take those fish when they're there.
I've seen three in the past 2 weeks come out of there with one of them being 1.20 meters. Like, I think it's time to chuck in a couple of potty mullet there, Pat, on a couple of live bait hooks because, like I said, I think they might have been bycatch, but it's just the fishing these days. There's no written book for it anymore, Pat. It's just things are happening. What do we go with global warming if you want to go with that one? So things are changing. So I don't really know why. I think it's sustainability of just the government's doing such good work, but it's really, really exciting. Heading to Queensland, Pat, your neck of the woods, Hitchinbrook, you've got a report for the barramundi out of there.
Yeah, there's been fish caught over the metre mark, which has been quite regular, which I suppose to us it's irregular, but some pretty damn good-sized fish and some crazy action out of the rivers with huge school of jelly prawns being sort of pushed up and then the GTs feeding on them. So that's pretty exciting in itself, Aaron.
Yeah, and amongst those prawns, so the Nerang River, and amongst the prawns getting pushed up against the walls, like you said, GTs, but not just GTs, like Big Eye, Brassy Trevally, Taylor, just to name a few. So good fish too, like proper 5+ to up to 10 kilo GTs, like really, really good fish in the river. So once again, there's no rule book, Pat.
Tasmania, Redmond. We've got a great report from our good friend Paul Worsling. He's been deep dropping off Eagle Hawk Neck, some 500 meters deep, and they've been getting some cracking hockey. which are one of the most beautiful eating fish in the sea. Now, I'm not sure I'm going deep dropping in 500 meters of water. They're using electric reels quite clearly, but they're a beautiful eating fish if you're happy to cast your lure down 500 meters, or your bait rather.
As well, in that same depth through the frost fish, those ribbon there, they literally look like a mirror on the outside. They sort of look like a gigantic eel. And those swordfish that are caught right along the continental shelf on the other side of it, in those depths, that's what's commonly in those frostfish. It's actually what's commonly in the swordfish stomachs. So that swordfish like eating them, and also they're fantastic eating for us too. They're a beautiful eat. Anything that's basically caught in the deep seems to be really, really good eating. So Paul also had a report where he managed to land and capture and release a 130-140 kilo mako too, filming for his iFish episode two out of Tassie as well. So he was out of, I was about to say Lord Howe Island there, but I was completely lied to you.
It's not Lord Howe.
Wrong place. Eagle Hawk neck. So it's, Tassie's just doing what Tassie does. Crayfish, he tells me little stories. Like he's just heading out and he's just leaves the house in the morning and drops his cray pot sitting on the way out. 20 Ks later, he's on the shelf catching all these and he comes up and catches a heap of striped trumpeter. And I'm just thinking, you got it pretty good, Paul. So it's going to be very exciting to watch on iFish in the next few months.
The iFish Summer Series is on now as well for those interested. Western Australia, the Metro Mackies out of Perth have been going really well. Just Halco lures, Redmond. It's pretty simple. And there's been yellowtail caught off Rottnest Island as well. There's been plenty of boats out, so it's been pretty busy. But for those interested in that part of the world, the yellowtail are certainly catchable and fishable. That wraps up our whip around Redmond. It's time for the social club. We take your questions from social media. Make sure you send us a direct message on our Facebook or Instagram, or better yet, download our Real Adventures app. The first question, Redmond, you've got it.
It is. It's from Larry. And I'm tipping you watched your social media during the week, Pat, because you're out with young George and your dad. And catching salmon on fly. Now his question is, with your techniques that you're using to catch salmon on the fly, do you think this will work on sunning tuna and as well as feeding kingfish as well?
Well, we've often spoken about this, Redmond, when we've talked about tuna sunning themselves. And the biggest challenge that you've always talked about is when tuna are sunning themselves, they're not really feeding. No. And I know I've asked you the question, well, what if we went really small on the fly, like exceptionally small? And the challenge is going to be getting them in a mood to actually bite. Now, when they're feeding on krill and really small crustaceans, that's the time to get your fly into the tuna. And you've had plenty of times, Redmond, where you've gone out and your report is they're there, they're feeding, but they're just not feeding on anything that you can present as a lure because they're just too big. So I've got no doubt when they're feeding on that sort of you know, those really small species, the fly would be a great way to fish for them. When they're sunning themselves a bit harder, kingfish, well, depending on the move they're on, Redmond.
Well, I think you nailed it. When they're sunning themselves, they're sunning themselves. They're literally just in the sun rolling. I think it's actually the other way. Rather than throwing a small fly in there to try and catch them, they're probably not even going to notice it. But if you get a big popper in there or a nice-sized popper and you're actually trying to piss
annoy
the fish
them
off.
Almost, yeah.
You're
trying to
annoy, you're trying to really fire, like you're trying to get a reactive bite out of it, and that does work. So I think it's actually the other way. I know on the kingfish, have you caught kings on the fly yet on the top water? Because I know you've been wanting to do it.
Yeah, I have. And 3 weeks ago, Mark Wagle from Millbrook Lakes, he fished off Barwon Heads and they got small kings on the fly. So it's a great way to fish for them. You need to go relatively heavy because kingfish are hard enough to catch on the best days, but you'd sort of want your 8 weight. But getting back to your question on salmon, it's a great way to fish for them. We pick the smallest flies possible, and they're a huge amount of fun. And there's plenty of really big salmon schools where we can get in quite close to them, turn the motor off, and then you're drifting around these huge schools. And it's a fast strip, and it's a really exciting way to fish for them.
Apologies, but bringing up old memories, George seems to be better on the net than the old man.
He had a ball. He loves fishing, but geez, he enjoyed the net. So he was holding the net at the back of the boat, brought it in, and he'd come in and be like, "Yeah, got it." So he's done a terrific job. Now we've run out of time, Redmond, because our wrap went a little longer. Apologies for that. Plenty more real adventures after the break. That was The Social Club.
Gearing up for Dometic. Everything you need for adventures, big or small. Mobile living made easy. Dometic.
It's time for gearing up for the Dometic Patrol, an icebox with a sense of adventure. Earlier in the week, I caught up with Christina Costales, and her partner John have been gallivanting up and down the eastern seaboard of Australia. The boat Takana is currently in the Whitsundays. John's doing some work there. Christina's doing some voiceover work at the Australian Open. Christina, thanks for joining me this morning. My wife and I, we were just chatting before off air, we've been watching your exploits, your and John's exploits over the last few months, and wondering in awe, one, to have the kahunas just to go, you know what, we're going to pack up everything that we have, we're going to buy a boat, and we're going to travel up the eastern seaboard of Australia. What were you thinking?
I was really excited, but we were extremely nervous. Obviously, we had only had, well, I had only had 5 days experience on a boat, let alone one that was 50 foot with no bow thruster. And John was, yeah, he was pretty nervous too, but, you know, we had just experienced a year and a half in lockdown in Melbourne and we were extremely over it. So, you know, we just kept on looking forward and the journey ahead seemed to be really exciting.
Now, I stumbled on your journey through Club Marine. You've written a wonderful article. And then at the end of the article, I discovered that you've done a YouTube series on it. And I think there's a difference between someone like me that picks up a GoPro and then films something and puts it on YouTube versus you. You're, by trade, you're a journo, so you know what you're doing. The episodes themselves, they're bloody sensational. They must take a huge amount of time.
Oh, yeah. The filming is just very spontaneous. So, you know, when we're doing something crazy or interesting or, you know, all hell breaks loose, then the camera's out. And you're right, though, the editing part is pretty time consuming. It takes about 3 days to edit an 18-minute video. But the content in terms of, like, getting the camera out and filming, it just flows and it just happens and everything you see is unfolding as it would naturally. And yeah, I hope that resonates.
So going back to the start, because I get a bit excited because I've loved the story so much. We're in lockdown 3.0 in Melbourne and you and John decide we're going to buy a boat, having very little sailing experience. You then do up the boat, which was a journey in itself, and you did most of the work yourselves, which was incredible. John must be pretty handy.
Yeah, he's phenomenal. Yeah, he's very savvy when it comes to that sort of stuff. Definitely. I'm his right-hand woman, but he's just the brains behind everything.
So then you reno the boat, Takana. It's absolutely beautiful. And as you mentioned before, it's 50 foot long. Like, it's not like your first foray into sailing was a 14 foot skiff. This is hardcore. It's a big boat and you get straight into, you know, launching through and sailing through Port Phillip Heads, which, you know, on this show we talk about fishing all the time and how dangerous it is going through Port Phillip Bay Heads, and you're doing that off very limited experience in a 50-foot boat. And there's, like, the motor that you've got, it's not exactly something that can get you out of trouble quickly. You're on your own steam with the sail.
Yeah, definitely. We threw ourselves in the deep end. We were definitely not after a 50-foot boat. We were after something a little smaller. We had something like, you know, a 40-foot in mind. But anyone who's out trying to look for a boat at the moment, there's there's not much on the market. So, you know, for us to do this experience, we had to, you know, improvise, and that's my 50-foot boat. I have to say, it was extremely nerve-wracking getting out of the berth. There were some very, very close calls, and I probably wouldn't recommend it actually without getting some experience and some practice. So we actually paid for a skipper to come on board and help us for a couple of hours. We still felt extremely nervous. There's no bow thruster, as I said earlier. So it was very, very, very extremely worrying. But, you know, once we were out of there, we waved to a few of our friends who came down to see us off, and it was such a beautiful experience. I was more excited about, you know, saying goodbye and, you know, farewelling our friends. And I remember John just going, "Christina, get the fenders, you know, like, you know, we're in boat mode now. This is serious." And, you know, I was just in this fairy tale dreamlike state, and John was already in skipper mode and trying to let me know the seriousness of what we're about to take on. And it was pretty wild going through the Bass Strait, I must say.
Well, speaking of, it's almost a baptism of fire. You enter Port Phillip Bay Heads into Bass Strait, and then you sailed on and on and on through the night. Those first few episodes, I think it was episodes 7 and 8, where you started to, you headed off on the journey, and I think it was the autopilot that was malfunctioning slightly, so you couldn't just keep sailing and trust it. John had to be up, and you had to be up, and you must have been buggered after those first few days.
100%. I think, you know, we only had, well, I only had that 5 days experience. We were able to do 2 weeks on someone else's boat, who actually turned out to be the previous owner, which was incredible. But at the same time, I still hadn't had any hands-on experience because, you know, that wasn't our boat. So, you know, when we were out in the Bass Strait, we felt very sort of like isolated and alone because it was just the two of us on board. Yeah. And it was just the two of us on board. And obviously John being a pilot, I don't know, I guess he just knew what to do. But at the same time, I think he might have felt even more isolated because he was the only one who felt comfortable behind the helm. So he stayed up for 18 hours. It was really unusual. It was a moonless night, so it was completely dark. We were obviously very isolated and, yeah, just two of us on board. And when the autopilot completely cut off intermittently, we were, I probably can't say this word, I was going to say I was shitting ourselves, but you know, we were,
bloody, I was,
can we say that? I was, and you know, we're going along and we just wouldn't know when it was going to cut out. And there was this one point in the sail where the autopilot was, you know, working for us. And then all of a sudden we've done this complete 180. We were going the other way back to Melbourne, but we didn't even realize it until we heard the head sail flapping. And at that point we realized, okay, we've got a big 4 days ahead of us because we didn't stop. We went from Melbourne to Sydney in 4 days, and it was only at nighttime that the autopilot was malfunctioning because
great time for it to malfunction.
Exactly. Because we later realized there were some issues with the solar panels and the power that was going to the batteries, and it's all rectified now. But at that stage, yeah, it wasn't ideal. And then, you know, we had that second situation whereby we were told that this could happen, but we didn't realize it was going to happen so early in the trip. But our furling line jumped off the furler and wrapped around the forestay. And that meant that we couldn't put our head sail away. And that was probably worse than the autopilot because John had to go to the bow of the boat in, you know, the rolling seas. I'm at the back of their helm looking up at him. He's got a screwdriver in his hand trying to, you know, get this line off the furler, and it was on tight. And he came back white, you know, seasick and feeling awful. But I was just practicing the man overboard situation over and over. It was hairy.
It must be, though, an incredible sense of achievement knowing the both of you, you're on this boat. If something goes wrong, well, you've got to turn to Mr. Fix-It. You've both got to work through it together because you can't exactly call the RACV and they'll come out and fix it. Like, you've got to become a jack of all trades when you're on a journey like you've been on.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish I did have more of a mechanical mind like John. And you're right, he is Mr. Fix-It. And at the same time, you know, I've tried to learn along the way I don't know. It's just, yeah, I'm just really lucky that we've had him on board, because I tell you what, we would have ended up on a reef multiple times this trip if it was left up to me. So I think we work definitely as a great team, though. I'm in the kitchen and, you know, I feed him.
You gotta eat.
And, you know, but, you know, in all seriousness, yeah, I think we do work. I don't mind getting my hands dirty as well, but yeah, we definitely, yeah, he's the brains.
Is it safe to say, though, it's taken John some time to feel comfortable in front of the camera? Because from episode one, where it seemed like he didn't really want to be there, and now, because for those listening, it's not just this has been, you know, the day on the boat and we've been here and that's it. You actually go into a bit of depth around the places that you journey to, a bit of the history behind those places. That's what I love about it, how much effort you actually put into that side of the production. But John's certainly more receptive to your questions around where we're going, what it means. It's just great.
I think I just wore him down. I didn't give him a choice, you know, because whenever something crazy was happening, I'd put the camera in his, well, not in his face, but, you know, I was just filming. And, you know, initially, yeah, he was very nervous. And I mean, we had no experience, and I'm about to put it online for the world to see. We were very vulnerable. but, you know, as we got more hours under our belt and I continued to pursue putting the camera in front of him. and not giving
him. You got him.
You know, I'm so grateful, though, because he is a wealth of knowledge, and I'm able that the world gets to see that side of him, because, yeah, we've got so much to share and so much to, you know, we've had so many messages from people saying, you know, you're the one who got us over the line to buy a boat. Yeah. And that just blows my mind. It blows my mind. And I have no doubt it's because, one, we have been honest in the journey. We've been able to share those experiences. And I hope, you know, that people also get to learn from the mistakes that we have made and the vulnerability that we've showed and some of those tips that John has also been able to share with everybody too.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of fun. Now, the places that you've been, this will be an almost impossible question to answer, but can you give me three destinations that are bucket list items for those looking to sail? Because there seems to have been so many of them, but are there three that you can sort of lock down and go, this was just an incredible place to experience by boat? And
yeah,
it's sort of hard to experience it any other way than sailing there.
Absolutely. I think Lizard Island is number one, top of the list. I mean, that's a place where people spend $2,500 a night in a resort to go to this beautiful remote island in North Queensland. And it is absolutely stunning. But if you go there by boat, it's free. Yeah. You know, you sail up to the anchorage and you put your anchor out and you get to experience paradise and magic. And it has to be one of the most spectacular Australian islands we witnessed on this trip. And we haven't reached that point in our YouTube journey yet. So I'm so excited to share that part of our trip with everybody. Another place that was definitely up there is Hinchinbrook. It's just absolutely stunning. We anchored off in a place called Zoe Bay, and it's crocodile territory there. So you also have that layer. And, you know, we hiked up to this sensational waterfall looking back over the bay, and we were the only ones crazy enough to be parking up in this location with the swell that we were experienced. But that's also another episode that's coming up further in this journey online. But that was just pure magic.
The challenge is, like, clearly a place like Hinchinbrook where you're dealing with significant tidal changes, and when you've got a draft of a sailboat that's 50 foot long, it's not like you wade through 3 foot of water. You need to calculate, you know, the changes that you're going to experience right throughout the day. So you've got to be careful with where you go.
Oh, absolutely, definitely. And where you're anchoring up as well. And yeah, we have a 2.2 meter draft. So we had to be very mindful of that. And unlike a catamaran where, you know, they can go up quite close to shore and get that protection, we weren't so lucky in some anchorages. So, you know,
that's the dinghy.
Yeah, we did have to cop the swell some nights when other people would just have an incredible, peaceful sleep. But I guess that's what comes with having a 2.2 meter draft.
So I know I've rambled on for too long. I've taken up too much time. We're under a bit of time pressure. But Christina Travels is where we search the journey. Can you tell us more about how to get on board and support and follow the trip? Because I've loved it so much, but as much as I've loved it, I'm a fishing and boating person. My wife is less so, but she's loved it just as much as I have. Oh. I think because of those things that you mentioned, it's real. You're experiencing, you know, what you guys are all by, you know, how we do in COVID times on the screen. How do we follow?
Well, it's. I wish it was Christina and John's travels, but again, you know, John was that introvert, so it's Christina's travels.
He didn't put the effort in early.
I know. He's like, no, this is your thing. So it's Christina's travels with a K, and I love that your wife is into it because a lot of women, you know, aren't into boating, and it's such a shame because it is such an invigorating experience, and you feel like you are living. And I guess I'd like to say, you know, we're a boating channel, but I think we're more a lifestyle as well, from, you know, that female's perspective, but also you get to see John's from a male's as well. So yeah, thank you so much for watching, and say thank you to your wife as well and for everyone. And I hope you really enjoy it. We've only just reached the most incredible spot, the Whitsundays, and we are heading all the way up to Lizard, and we have so much to share. So yeah, check it out and start from the beginning when we buy Takana. Yeah. It was wild from the start, and it just keeps on getting crazier as we go. And we also have a near miss, extremely wild experience as well at Lady Musgrave. We had an experience where we dragged anchor with bombies all around us. That's coming up as well. And we had a guy that anchored too close to us in the middle of the night during a storm, and we were up against each other. So there are some wild experiences ahead.
We're looking forward to it, Christine. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you this morning. Thanks again.
Oh, thank you, Patrick, for having us.
That was Gearing Up for the Dometic Patrol, an icebox with a sense of adventure.
Red's review for Club Marine, Australia's leading provider of boat insurance.
It's now time for Red's review for Club Marine. And this week, on the back of the Mako that you caught earlier in the week, Redman, we're talking about traces, whether you make them at home yourself, you buy them off the shelf, and the importance of size.
Yeah, it's a good question. And once again, there's a few elements that come into it. Number one's trust. Do you trust what you buy? Number two is, I guess, it's price on the pricey side of things when you want to buy things that are already made, especially locally made. There is a lot of quality out there. I follow a guy's Predator Tackle on social media. They make up shark traces, and I see people down at 90 Mile Beach catching bloody 250 kilo bronzies off the beach and the odd hammerhead or whatever it is, and they seem to work really, really well. So there are definitely companies out there that sell them, but for me, I much prefer to make them myself. It comes down to the length of shark, the length of the wide trace I want to use for each sort of species of sharks. Now, if I'm running circle hooks, you all know that I really like to actually have a circle hook sort of kick back on itself. So I tend to run slightly thinner wire, maybe around that 120-pound wire, and I like to actually kink it on itself so the circle rolls back and will hook that shark in the corner of the jaw. Where a fixed hook, I actually don't worry – a straight hook. I don't actually worry about fixing it as such like I do when I'm trawling for a barrel bluefin. And what I mean by that is the hook actually stays fixed. I use a figure eight knot around the hook where it actually goes through the eye and keeps the hook firm in one spot. It sits upright in the lure in one spot. Where for a shark trace, I use what's called a cat's paw knot. And it's pretty simple. You just go, you basically make a circle with the wire, go through the hook, then come back through that circle, and then you actually crimp it on yourself. It's actually quite easy, and it's just a traditional swinging hook. Now, the reason I say this, because I haven't got too long, is if I'm tracing a thresher, I might only want, say, 30 meters of trace. Now, the reason for that is you don't want too much wire in the water because they can be timid at times. I'd rather have a wind-on leader of 200 pound or 150 pound or 120 rather than having a nice 2 meter trace. So with a Mako, they're not as funny with the wire. So you can buy one and run it nice and long. But for me, it's definitely about making it myself, running the size of the hooks I want for the size of the sharks that I believe I'm going to catch. I have three or four different sizes on the boat, depending on the shark that comes up to the boat traditionally. And also the crimping gear, you need to get wire, little crimps, and the actual tool itself will actually crimp up the wire. You don't need anything different than what you do for when you're chasing big bluefin or crimping any gear, for any fish that you're chasing.
That's Shark Traces, and that is Red's review for Club Marine.
That was Red's review for Club Marine. Insure your boat or jet ski with Club Marine, Australia's leading provider of boat insurance. Check the PDS to see if this insurance is right for you.
You're listening to Real Adventures with Patrick Dangerfield and Aaron Hadgood.
Welcome back to Real Adventures. It's time for Red's Tip for Go Fish Nagambi, happening from the 10th to the 13th of February. Entries on sale now. Cast your way to 80 grand. This week on Red's Tip, we're talking about slightly deflating your tyres, Redmond, but it's not something you have to do every time you drive your car onto the beach. And this is off the back of a few questions we've had, Redmond, about the beach launching that we do, and do we always deflate our tyres? Well, if we're launching in an area where the sand is really soft, whether that's an access ramp and we're coming up onto dry, soft sand, or you can walk along the sand and just feel it under your feet where it starts to absorb any weight and you start to fall through it. If you're in that sort of scenario, well, yes, absolutely. It makes sense to deflate your tyres to a certain extent. But if we're launching, Redmond, in regions where the access to the beach is really good, the sand is really hard, and we've got our method down pat with the way that we launch the boat, we put it in reverse, we take the steady back, we drop it off the boat, we drive forward, and then when we retrieve the boat, we essentially use a snatch and strap and we skull drag the boat up far from the water's edge, then very rarely do we ever deflate the tyres because it's a bit of a pain in the ass. Is it something worth doing when you know you're under pressure and the beach is soft? Absolutely. Is it something we do every time? The reality is, we'll be totally honest, as we always are on this show, it's not something that we do every time, Redmond.
Yeah, well, you and your dad are very familiar with it because you do a lot of beach launching, so I wouldn't be listening to me on that one. I reckon I actually listen to you for a change.
It doesn't mean that we never get bogged, but it's just being honest.
I know that because I got a phone call at Aries Inlet Cafe buying you breakfast one day with you swearing.
Can you get over that?
No, I was sad.
Get anyway. Over it. And that was Red's Tip for Go Fish Nagambi on February 10 to February 13. Every fisho is in with a chance at Go Fish Nagambi on February 10 to February 13. Enter now.
Yes, I'm taking the gap. I've had to work myself up. The Aries Inlet just warmed me up like I did that bacon and egg. jet ski drivers.
Oh, I'm with you here. What now, are you going to say? I'm with you.
Now, there's a reason that the most fines that go out on the bay are to jet ski drivers. Now, but there are some fantastic ones. I met a young fellow that's got a jet ski all kitted out for fishing during the week. We caught some magnets.
There's four of them in the state.
He was one of them. And he was a really good bloke. Did the right things, fished. Well, I'm finding the fishermen jet ski riders are the better ones because they're actually on the same page as you. Mate, yes. During the week, I shit you not what happened to us. I had five of them coming towards us, and I'd shut up on the water. I don't talk on the radio. I don't yell. I don't scream. I literally shut up. I don't do anything. Even if anyone really annoys me on the water, I just shut up. I just don't do anything. I can't be bothered with any conflicts anywhere. I just shut up. Anyway,
can you do that around me next time?
No, because you really go past that line. It's you're more than the jet ski times. This jet ski rider was zigzagging side to side, like just going quite quick.
A Muppet.
And I'm just trolling for tuna, and I'm watching him come from hundreds of meters away. I'm running two teaser bars, one probably, say, 15 meters, the other one on the back of my watch, say, 35 meters. Right, like relatively, like not stupidly far, but they're far. This zigzagged in my wake and gone over my shotgun teaser bar, over the top of him, zigzag around it, and then three of his mates did the exact same freaking thing. Literally straight through. I'm screaming at the back of the boat. Like they're only just there and they could hear me. The first guy thought I was talking to him. So he comes back around and does the same thing, coming back that way to come to that side of me, to come talk to me. Like, what? Why do you have to be within 20 or 30 meters of a boat? You're in the middle of the freaking Bass Strait. Go anywhere you want to go. Like, just stay away from all the boats. Now, these aren't the fishing guys. These are the ibises of the sea. So they just stay away from boats. Just do your own thing. Stay away from people swimming and don't do the right thing, because you've built the name for yourself. And like you said, there's not many that do the right thing. I apologize to anyone who does do the right thing if you're a jet ski driver, because I love jet skis. They're good fun. But for some reason, when they get on them, 90% of them turn into imbeciles.
Imbeciles.
It must be the switch. I don't know what it is. Something happens as you turn it on and just like generates power through you to be a real idiot. So anyway, that's it.
Beautiful work. That wraps Real Adventures this morning. We hope you've enjoyed the show. We'll see you next week.